You're listening to episode 4, season 2 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, storytellers! We have young adult author Mindy Arnett with us today. Mindy's books have been chosen as School Library Journal Best Book of the Year and Indigo's Best Teen Books. In today's episode, Mindy and I chat a lot about her process in writing and creating her two very popular young adult book series. The first one being a contemporary fantasy called the Arkwell Academy series, and the second one, a fast-paced sci-fi adventure called the Avalon series. Mindy gives incredible insight into the world of writing for young adult fiction that applies to writers of all genres. Now let's jump right in.
Hey, storytellers, guess who we have? We have Mindy Arnett with us today. I'm so excited to have her on the show. Mindy, thank you so much. I'd love to know how you fell in love with writing.
I fell in love with writing because I love to read, and I think that's true of most storytellers. You know, when I was little, I played very elaborate games with my toys. You know, I played with Briar horses and My Little Ponies, and they were very involved stories where, you know, a pony got abducted and had to fight its way free. And I loved story. And as I eventually learned how to read, of course, fell in love with the written word. And I had never really thought about where stories come from. You know, I just assumed that they were just there. They were just these things. But then I went into the sixth grade, and my teacher gave us a weekly writing assignment, a creative writing assignment, where she would give us a prompt and say, here's your prompt, and I want you to write a short story. This was like my Lucy stepping into the wardrobe moment, or like getting the keys to the TARDIS. I mean, it just opened my eyes to this reality that not only could I enjoy reading stories, I could tell my own, and the world could be anything I wanted it to be, and there was no limit. And that is the moment, the very moment when I became in love with writing and stories, and I knew that's all I wanted to do.
Oh, I love that. And from there, I see that you went to college for writing. And how do you think that helped you with your writing career right now?
The thing about any kind of education does not have to be specific to writing. My degrees are actually in English literature with an emphasis in creative writing. So I did both. The beauty of higher education is just really that critical thinking. You know, you get there and you're a freshman and you're like, why do I need to take this crazy class about, you know, Western economics or something that you thought you're like, this has nothing to do with what I want to do as a job. And then as you get a little bit older, you realize, oh, well, the reason being is because you need to see the whole world and you need to be able to critically think and evaluate. And as a writer, there really is no more important skill than that kind of critical thinking and kind of being able to evaluate your story, your characters, you know, the environment that they're taking place in. So any kind of formal education is good for a writer. And that is definitely true of me. Obviously, as an English literature major, I learned how to analyze texts, how to look for theory, themes, and subtext and be able to layer those in. Definitely a good thing to do. And then I got a job technical writing after school so I could actually pay my bills.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right. I don't do that anymore, but that's what I did when I first graduated.
So technical writers, what exactly do they do?
A technical writer writes any kind of manual that you get. And if in my case, I worked for the Air Force, so they were aircraft maintenance manuals. So the airmen that fly these planes, they carry these big manuals with them if something breaks. And so you have a technical writer that actually takes the technical specifications from the engineers and, you know, the people that actually built the plane. And then they turn it into layman's type of writing and they put it into the manual so that, you know, your enlisted guy over here who's right out of college can pick it up and go to a certain section and say, oh, here's how I repair this flashing red light on this airplane, that kind of.
Oh, that's so cool. So you're able to make money off of that.
Correct. You can actually get a job as a tech writer. You can't get a job as an author. There's no wanted author positions out there, but there are wanted technical writers. And that's what I did right out of school. And then I worked writing in the background and I continued on with my career and moved on from technical writing into more other technical stuff. But that was just kind of the doorway because you got to be able to eat, you know, and pay your bills while you're trying to do this whole writing, creative art pursuit.
Thank you so much for sharing that, by the way, because like you mentioned, you do need to survive
and feed yourself while pursuing your dream.
Right.
So thank you for sharing that with the listeners so that in case they are seeking jobs where they can support themselves or help to bring in income while working on their stories, this is something they can look into. But that sounds really fascinating. Do you know anything about the aerospace, like the engineering, or were you chatting with the engineers and then they tell you like the specific details and then you have to, in your own words, translate it to something that's more understandable? Is that how it works?
It happens in both ways. It depends on what you're working on specifically. A lot of times the documents are pre-existing. So you're updating a current, a living document with new specifications. So you're not starting from scratch. You literally get a big stack of wiring diagrams. And then my job was to look about how you would isolate a problem on the diagram. So I would literally take look at point A and point B and those kinds of very basic instructions. In those cases, what I would do, I would not be talking with an engineer directly. I would be using their pre-made material. And then eventually, once I got enough of the writing done, I would send it back to them and then they would kind of evaluate whether or not it was accurate and make any changes that way. So that was more the back and forth on that.
Wow, that sounds so badass.
It's not quite as badass as it sounds. Except, you know, I did fly out and actually get to go on the airplanes.
What?
This actually has a bearing on my writing. I write science fiction.
Yes.
And I write space-based science fiction. And a lot of that has to do with my Air Force background.
Oh, is that how your inspiration for the Avalon series?
Absolutely. The actual ship, Avalon, and just kind of the language that I use, and I have a lot in my tool bag that I picked up from actually working on airplanes. And, you know, we used to go out with our manuals and we would actually get on the airplane. And the techs, you know, the Air Force guys would go through and try and break stuff and fix it based on what we had written. So I've actually been inside military grade planes and just kind of how they go together. I really relied on that a lot for my Avalon books in making my own spaceship.
Oh, that's so awesome. And I would love to know how you create your characters. Like, I think it's so cool that in your series, the Arkwell Academy series, the main character, Dusty Everhart, she's literally a nightmare. Like, that's so creative. Where on earth did you get that from?
If you study creative writing in college, you're going to write primarily short stories. It has to do with the format of the class. It's really hard to work on a novel in a single class that only lasts 10 weeks. Mm. So you focus on short stories, and I love horror stories. It's one of my favorite things to write. And so I wrote a lot of horror stories, and I was looking for a monster in a short story I was working on. And I stumbled across the nightmare as an adult. Now, I had read about a young person, one of my favorite authors. I also own horses. So anything that has the word mare in it, which is a horse word, mm-hmm. is going to grab my attention because, you know, I'm a horse nut. And one of my favorite authors who actually writes about horses, Jennifer Robertson, she's a fantasy author. She wrote a short story about a nightmare that was an actual black horse that it had that creature in it, you know, the demon-y type of creature. So I revisited that and I was like, wow. And I looked at a painting called by Henry Fuseli. It's called The Nightmare, and it's a picture of this woman on a bed, and her hair is hanging off the end, and on top of her chest is this little demon-ish creature, because that's what nightmares do. They sit on your chest when you're trying to sleep and give you bad dreams. Well, when I saw that, I was like, you know, it kind of bothers me that this woman laying here and the demon is sitting on top. I'm like, what if we flip that around? What if we take the nightmare instead of being a demon? Let's make it a girl and give her some empowerment. And as soon as that happened, I was like, wow, you know, that would really be a crappy job to have, to be, you know, this girl who has to go and feed on dreams, and how, you know, how much that would suck. And I thought, not only would it suck, but it would be really funny, you know, because people when they sleep are just, you know, they can be pretty funny. They're drooling, they're naked. I mean, you know. And as soon as I had that, I was like, I got to write this story. And it actually started off as an adult story at first. And then I was like, well, if it was going to stay adult, it was going to get pretty raunchy pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to go there. I felt like the humor played more fun for me with a younger character. And so that's when I stepped into the young adult world, and I have not looked back.
And how did you actually come up with Dusty Everhart? How did you make her so relatable and, I guess, human-like?
Well, thank you. The character is always a process for me. My main character is the character I would most want to be in the story. You know, you're going to spend 3 months with these people. You know, I want to like the person I'm pretending to be, like I'm an actor. You know, I think that's kind of how I think of it. So I pick something about the person that I would be fun. Like with Dusty, she can do magic. She's not like me at all. She's really klutzy and, you know, she gets into trouble. And I'm very straight A. I don't mess up very often. I don't like to be in trouble. I'm very reserved. And so I wanted her to be different from me because it's more fun. So that's where I start. And then as the layering happens, as, you know, we go through the story, every juncture in each chapter, I'm asking myself, you know, I'll have an instinct about what the character is going to do next. And then before I let them do that, I ask myself, why are they doing this? What is their internal motivation for this behavior? And as long as I can answer that question, then they get to do whatever it is they think they want to do. And that helps me avoid having flat characters, having characters that are just serving a purpose instead of actually inhabiting a real world. At every moment, including my villains, I'm asking the question, why are they behaving this? What are they getting out of this? If I were this person, why would I be doing this? And that's how I deal primarily with characters.
And do you have a map using note cards or index cards, or do you have like a little graph or chart that you write what each character wants? And does that help you with the plot of the story as well? Like, how's your process of the story development in itself?
I actually do all of those things.
Oh.
And when I wrote The Nightmare Affair, you know, it was not my first novel, my first published novel. And with that one, I kept a notebook and I would have pieces of paper and I would write notes on them. And then eventually the notebook got to be tedious, so I moved over to note cards. And now these days I have both note cards and I also do Excel spreadsheets. So my note cards, I will write down plot points and I also do character cards. And that's where I record things that they're doing, things that they're feeling, things I need to watch out for in terms of, are they behaving in a way that makes sense? And that's always a problem with the villain. You know, why is the villain acting like a bad guy? And so I keep track of it there. And then my Excel spreadsheet, I actually track each chapter. I track where it starts, who it's about, what parts of the main plot it deals with, what parts of the subplot. And I color coordinate it so that I can make sure that each chapter contains all elements in it and so that nothing is extraneous, you know, that it can be taken. You know, if you have a chapter that doesn't need to be there, it shouldn't be there. And that's how I avoid writing those chapters, is by doing that.
Oh, wow. I've never heard of anyone using Excel. Thank you for sharing that, because that's also inspiring for the listeners, too, to check that out and try it for themselves if they're ever stuck. So I'm assuming then when you're writing this book, you sound like you already know everything that's going to happen, or is there wiggle room for free flow?
No, I know nothing that's going to happen. Oh. I don't. The metaphor I use for this, it's a little bit like playing Minesweep, the game. You remember the game Minesweep?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Right. So I have an idea. I have very vague, like I know that there are bombs on this game when you're playing it. What happens, you know, you push the little squares and a whole bunch of stuff opens up all at once. That's what writing is like for me. I will have an idea of what's coming and I move towards it. And as I move towards it, I get a clearer and clearer picture of where it's going. So usually the ending is like the shadow of a mountain in the distance, but I really can't see any details about that mountain. I just know that I got to get there. I'm definitely a pantser. I'm a terrible plotter. I've tried to outline before and it was a complete disaster. and the reason being is because in real life, I am a planner. If I set a plan, I'm going to follow that plan because that's what I do. That's who I am. Well, the problem is in writing, if you set a plan and you don't really know your characters well enough yet because you haven't spent enough time with them, what you're setting could be wrong. They could be acting in ways that don't make sense. You could have just simply not had enough foresight. Well, the problem was, as I wrote this book, following my outline, I followed it very carefully and I made mistakes because I didn't do my normal, you know, why is this character behaving this way? And so I stymied myself by following my plan too closely. So for me, the fun of writing and the natural aspect of it is to not know what's going to happen next, but kind of figure it out logically as I'm going. And also, you know, what's fun? What could we do in this next chapter that would be a lot of fun to read and a lot of fun to write? And that's how my stories get made.
I'm really curious as to where you got the inspiration of creating the world that you did for the Arkwell Academy series. Like, there are mermaids, there's this nightmare main character. Do you ever have dreams where you just jot it down after you wake up, like, oh, that was something that I never would have thought of, but that might be a good idea to add into this story? Like, where do you get this inspiration from?
The only dreams I've ever had have been from my horror stories.
Oh.
So usually those are my nightmares. I've never had that Stephanie Meyer moment where I woke up and had this wonderful story. No, what happens for me instead is that I have a very technical background and I'm very interested in the way things work logically. So what happens when I'm building a world, I build from the ground up, which means I know what my character is and I know what they can do. And then I start to fill in what the world would be like based on what they can do. You know, right away with, I have a nightmare, which is considered a dark creature. You know, they are villains in most of the texts. They're demons. I wanted to have a complex about being considered a dark character. But I wanted to also be dynamic and to have a lot more. I'm like, well, what if we have these labels that, you know, and I actually dealt with it in terms of, you know, racism in our country, which is a huge issue. What if these class of characters had been labeled based on the way their magic works? And that's where I came up with dark kind, you know, nature kind. And I just made decisions based on what makes it make sense in a logical world. It's really boring when you talk about it in those terms. I'm the kind of person when I'm watching a movie, I want to know how did they get there so fast? You know, like if they're in one moment they're in Africa and the next moment they're in the United States. I'm like, well, did they take a plane? And how long was that plane ride? And I asked myself these questions as I'm watching, you know, sci-fi movies. And I'm going, that makes no sense. How did that happen? You know, and even though 95% of that kind of anal retentive, you know, questioning does not end up in the book, I've got to be able to explain to myself how they got there in case somebody were to ask. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if you were to ask me a very technical question, I'm going to be able to answer it. And it makes sense and not just be, well, I have no idea how they got there. I feel like in a lot of movies that, you know, your directors would be like, I have no idea. Who cares? They're there, you know?
Yeah, those little details that they sometimes brush under the rug. It's so funny because it does sound like very technical when you're brainstorming and thinking about it behind the scenes. And when it comes to the Avalon series, that is actually pretty technical. So what inspired to write the Avalon series? Was that immediately you got that idea after you finished your Arkwell series? Or were you thinking about the Avalon series, perhaps maybe even before you wrote the Arkwell series?
I wrote Avalon right after the first book in the Arkwell series.
Oh.
When you publish a book, when you sell a book, you know, the editor buys it, but it doesn't come out for 2 years. 18 months is pretty average for when they first buy a book. Well, what do you do in 18 months? Well, my agent was like, let's work on something new. What do you have? And I knew I wanted to write a sci-fi because I love sci-fi as much as I do fantasy. You know, my sister is one of my favorite readers. And she was like, you know, Minnie, there's hardly any young adult space-based sci-fi. Why don't you do this? So that's where I started. And I pitched the idea to my agent. She's like, go for it. So I wrote the book and we sold it to a different publisher before the Nightmare Fair ever came out. Mm. So I debuted twice. So I wrote these books back and forth.
Wow. That is insanely incredible. How did you keep up with that?
I have no life.
And I'm really organized as well.
I am really organized. I get a good night's sleep every night, which is, I tell people, you know, they ask me a secret to my success. And I'm not being glib when I say that. I do. I make sure I get enough sleep. And if I can get enough sleep, I can do a whole lot in a single day.
Oh my God, sidetracking. How many hours of sleep do you get a night?
I get between 7 and 8 every night.
Man. So you basically have like two different walls, like one whole wall for the Arkwell Academy series, another wall mm-hmm. filled with like note cards from the Avalon series. Is that how it works?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't put it on my wall. I keep it in my bag, but yes.
How do you keep that organized? What?
Well, I mean, they're note cards, so they're already, you know, they're already neat, like little cards, you know, I just flip through them.
Oh my God. Mine would be all over the place.
Because I do so much thinking and planning as I go, there's not a whole lot, maybe 30 cards by the end of it. When I'm drafting every day. And I'm thinking about it every day. And so I'm able to keep up with, you know, what's going on in the whole story. And again, because I don't do a lot beforehand, you know, I'm doing it as I go. So it's pretty easy to maintain that. And I forget your original question. What was it? Oh, the inspiration for Avalon. Was that the question?
Yes.
Okay. So I knew I wanted to write an adult space-based. And I absolutely loved Firefly. And I wanted to have a story that had a Firefly feel. I wanted to recreate it. You know, my heart was broken because that series got canceled. And so that's kind of where I started. And a whole bunch of ideas came together for Avalon. It was not one single thing. I had recently listened to an inspirational speech by a man named Rob Bell. It was called Everything is Spiritual. And it's really entertaining if you ever, you know, have a couple of minutes to watch something. But he deals with all the science in the beginning and just how everything in the universe breaks down into science. And he talked about ideas I had never heard before, like, you know, the idea of the book Flatland. You had a world where there was only two dimensions and you actually inserted a three-dimensional object into it. What would that look like to the creatures that were two-dimensional? Mm. And that got me thinking about the idea of metaspace, which of course is my version of hyperspace. You know, it's a way to travel across the universe. Like, what if you have creatures that have a dimensional perception that we humans don't have? We have height, width, we have depth and time. What if we had a fifth dimension where you could perceive all of time instead of just, we can only see it going forward because that's who we are. We move forward in time. Well, if you had a being that could see it both forwards and backwards, they could, in theory, travel through space. So that's where the idea of the space travel came from. And at the same time, I married that idea with what's going on with our coral reefs. It's concerning to me that we have these coral reefs that are bleaching because of all the chemicals we're putting on it, and what this is going to have in the long-term impact. So all of those things came together to form the story of Avalon. I can't really say a lot more without giving away spoilers, but suffice it to say the creatures that have that ability to travel through space are like coral that are dying, and you know we as humans are causing it, and we need to fix it, which is kind of what those books end up being about.
How do you work on your first draft? I know you keep your organized note cards all together. Do you end up handwriting your first draft? Do you find that's easier, or do you transfer it into on the computer?
I type. My handwriting is so bad that I can't even read it. Especially if when I'm writing a story, I'm writing very fast. My hand cannot keep up with it. Even my fingers when I'm typing can't keep up with my brain. I do all of my actual drafting on the computer. I do all my thinking about it, though, by hand. So all my free writing is done with pen and paper because they say you use a different part of your brain when you are writing. And I do believe that. So if I'm stuck in particular, I'll take out a piece of paper and say, why am I stuck? Why is this not working? And I'll literally write that out and then eventually hopefully come to the answer. As I'm drafting, I keep track. I set daily word goals and I have a little notebook, a little tiny little notebook, the kind you can kind of fit in your pocket, where I set down where my word count was the day before, how many I want to get done today, and then how many I actually get done. And that's how I keep myself on target and on track. And I have a very modest goal. I write 1,000 words a day. Mm. That's my goal. I usually exceed it, but not always.
So you're constantly always writing every single day, no matter how much or how little?
Correct. When I'm drafting. And, you know, and of course, things happen. Life happens. There are days when I don't get the writing done. But I try, for the most part, to do it every single day when I'm drafting.
Wow. How do you manage that? Because I know you have a family.
I do.
So how do you manage doing that and being able to make time for your craft, for your art, for your love, but also make time to be with your kids, to see your husband? Like, how does that, like, how are you able to balance that?
A lot of self-sacrifice, a lot of sacrifice. You know, before I started publishing, I was always writing, but I wrote slower. I could take my time. And, you know, there's a lot of things I used to do that I'm not currently able to do, like my horses, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my horse riding career really just has taken a back seat because I want to spend time with my kids instead. And so it involves a lot of sacrifice. Now, hopefully someday, you know, because I still work a day job on top of all of that.
Wow.
So hopefully someday, you know, the books pay off enough that I can do it full time. And then I'll be able to, you know, enjoy those things I used to. I watch very little TV. My husband and I do that together. So, you know, that's one thing we do.
Aww.
I don't do a lot of what I used to do. I don't go out and party. I hardly go to the movies. And the other thing is just learning how to get in and get out and not waste time when I do have time to write.
That's true.
That's a discipline thing. You know, that's just something you have to learn by doing. It took me a while. You know, I've gotten a lot better.
Is it hard if, like, let's say you're in the middle of writing, but then one of your kids are like, really like, mom, I really want you to spend time with me right now, or I really want you to play with me right now. Isn't it hard to say no, you know, when they're looking at you with those cute little eyes? Like how does that work? Or do you have an actual conversation? Like, listen, mom is working on her dream and this is also my writing career. Like, how do you have that discussion, that dialogue to let them understand this is mommy's time to write? So you have to respect that.
They're really young, so they don't really. they're 8 and 6. And so what I do instead, like yesterday, you know, I'm working on my current book and they had to do Valentine's Day for school. And so what I did was I sat down at my desk and I put them on either side of me and let them work on their Valentines while I worked on my book.
Aww.
It's not ideal because obviously every couple of seconds they want to talk to me. But, you know, you have to learn be able to kind of tune out what you can and kind of keep going and not let yourself get distracted. And we had fun. And that happens a lot. You know, they'll come and they'll have an iPad and they'll come and pretend like they're typing beside me, or they'll read a book, or they'll color, you know, they'll do stuff. And we do that a lot too.
Oh, so that's when you get to do a lot of your private writings.
Or, you know, when they're in bed, you know, after they've gone to sleep or, you know, that kind of stuff. So.
Oh, I love that. That's so awesome. And your quality time with your husband is watching TV then?
Well, we love the same shows.
Okay, that definitely helps.
He's a fireman, so he's gone every third day. So,
oh, that's,
you know,
really hot. Jeez, that's awesome.
So every third day, I have to deal with the kids, of course, but I, you know, he's away every 48 hours. So
I always love asking about family, and because I'm a huge family person and I see the realities of, you know, just growing up and seeing like, oh, man, it's a lot of work keeping a family intact and keeping your marriage spicy. And like, you know, it's realities of things. You know, I used to grow up thinking, it's fairy tales. And it's just like, oh, actually, no, it requires a lot of hard work. And you really have to know how to balance your time. And, you know, you have to keep committed to that. That's a job in itself. Well, Mindy, I'd like to know if you can share a moment in your writing career or even in your life overall where it was really, really dark and you felt like you almost couldn't get out of that situation. If there's any stories like that you can share with us and the listeners.
I actually have several. I'll try and keep that down. So this is more to people that finally go through the publishing process. You know, you don't know what you're getting into until you're into it. And there are some wonderful things about publishing. And there's a lot of really terrible things at the same time. But if you're lucky enough to be that writer who writes a bestseller, a major super bestseller right out the door, which your chances of doing that are like winning the lottery. So good luck. With anything in life, you know, you don't really know what you're getting into until you do it. And of course, all new writers have no idea what they're in store for. And there's a lot of really good things that you're in store for and a lot of really, really hard things at the same time. And the thing about publishing is that, you know, every day you're surrounded by new deals, new successes. And, you know, you try really hard to say, well, to be really happy for your friends, which, you know, you are, but at the same time you struggle with, well, my book maybe didn't do as well, or, oh, I didn't get that book tour, or, oh, I didn't sell film rights. It's a constant pressure, this pressure to succeed. Mm. You really have to have the numbers. You really have to have good sales in order to guarantee the next sale. If you're not, you know, the Veronica Roth, you know, Suzanne Collins, Stephen King, if you're that person, then anything you write, they're going to publish. Yay for you. But for the rest of us, you know, we have to seriously consider, is my next book going to get picked up? I went through a period between, you know, I wrote two series at the same time. So for the first 3 or 4 years, I was writing books on contract and not able to start anything new during that time period. So I kind of, it was a real eye opener to kind of start over at the beginning once I got through those and to start with new stories. It was very difficult to kind of shut the world out and remember, why am I actually writing a book? It's not really to be published. I mean, it is obviously, but you know, I'm writing it because I really like to write and I love stories. And there for a little while, between the publication of Avalon and Polaris, probably, I really struggled with, you know, about a depression. Some personal things were going on, you know, and the books, then they've done well. I'm not going to complain. My publisher has been very good to me. I've had a lot of good things happen. But there's still that constant pressure, that reality that regardless, it's always going to be a battle. The next book is always going to be hard. Nothing is ever going to come just, you can't take it for granted. Like, you know, there is no doing that in publishing. You have to have a lot of grit and a lot of self-confidence to write a book anyways. Mm. You know, because you got to be like, well, I'm good enough that people are going to want to read this. You know, you really have to have some ego to write a book. You know, even if you keep it, your little ego under your little bushel, you know, you still have to have it.
Yeah.
And when you go through the ringer and you've got, you know, you're in, all of a sudden you're in this very exposed public view, you know, and you're surrounded by numbers and, you know, all these things. You got to remember that grit and that self-confidence because nobody is going to remember it for you. No matter how great they are and how much they love your books, nobody can do it for you. So you have to really kind of pick yourself up by the bootstraps and keep going. I'm sure you've heard it before. Other writers will tell you the only thing you can do is write the next book. And I went through a period where I was not able to write for a while until finally I just kind of purged and got over it. And now I'm writing the next book, whether they're going to buy it or not. I'm going to learn and write and publish and just keep going. You know, you think, oh, I got the book deal. I don't have to worry about that anymore. And that's actually not the case. You know, you really do have to continue to push yourself forward. No one is going to push it for you.
Mm. And for the listeners who may be going through what you've gone through and are currently in that state where they really feel this depression where they just can't get themselves out of it. I know you mentioned that you just got to a point where you realized, like, I just got to keep writing. But was there something that helped to trigger that?
I don't want to talk about anything really sensitive, but I would say for me, you know, it's the sense of a higher power.
Right.
I'm not going to spew any kind of religion at you, but definitely, you know, again, you have that ego because you're writing. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You really do. I really believe that. And there are probably people that are saying, you're crazy, but I'm not. You really do have to believe that what you're saying is good enough that people are going to want it. And you have to have that, whatever. But at the same time, you got to remember that the world does not revolve around you and that there are bigger things and there's a bigger purpose. And, you know, and that is really what it was for me, was I had forgotten about that, that there is more to this world than writing. There's more to the world than, you know, than money. There are things outside of yourself that are more important. The thing about depression is that it's so self-focused. It's like the swamps of sadness in the movie, The Neverending Story. Have you ever seen The Neverending Story?
Yes.
Right. So that is a metaphor for depression. You know, that when you go through the swamps of sadness, you are just stuck and it's pulling you down and it's pulling you down and it's pulling you down. And I just use the word you 4 times. In reality, it's me, me, me. And, you know, and you become so focused on yourself because you can't help it because your emotions have gotten so hard of you. That for me, the only way to get out of it was to focus on something bigger than myself, something outside of that. You know, you make your own happiness, and it really just kind of learning to do that, to be happy with, because I have so many good things in my life. I mean, I have it made. I have it made. Don't let anybody tell you different. Mm-hmm. I mean, including myself, you know, I have it made. I have so many good things. And you just got to remember the good things and you focus outwardly instead of inwardly. Mm-hmm. And that's what pulled me through and learning to be content with my situation, regardless of what it is and how it does. And remembering that I am writing books because I love to write books and because I have things to say about this world that I hope other people will get to hear and, you know, learn from. And if there's even a chance of that happening, I'm going to keep writing regardless of no's, regardless of rejections, regardless of failures. And just really, again, keep that upward, you know, keep my eye above the problem and not focused on the problem.
Wow, thank you. I got goosebumps from that. Now, talking about focusing on good things, please share with us a moment where you really was the highlight of your career and your writing career that you'll never forget. It always puts a smile on your face.
Oh, gosh, it's so hard.
Oh, that's good. Sounds like you're very grateful about a lot of things. So that's amazing to hear.
It actually goes both ways. On the one hand, you know, there's been so many good things. On the other hand, they feel so fleeting, you know, like because it's so easy to get sucked in that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not good enough and I'm not doing well enough.
I feel you.
Well, I'll just pick one. I absolutely adore my Avalon editor. He's amazing. When he bought that book, which it did not sell very quickly. Now, my Nightmare Affair sold in 17 days. It was amazing. It was amazing.
Damn.
Right? I keep saying, oh my God, let this happen again. But no, of course, it's not happening. Nightmare Affair took about 4 months. And my editor, the first time I talked to him on the phone, he was getting on a plane and he had Avalon downloaded to read it. And the plane got canceled, you know, for weather or something. And so he rented a car and he listened to Avalon on the Kindle with the little person that narrates on the Kindle. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yes.
Have you ever heard it?
I have not heard it before, but I know about it.
It's terrible. The voice is just very robotic.
Oh, no.
It doesn't know how to pronounce, you know, certain words.
Oh, is that how the Kindle works? Okay, with the audio version, I thought it was an actual audio voice actor reading it. So it's not.
There's two different things. So you have audiobooks that has like a professional actor that reads them, and those are wonderful.
Yeah.
The Kindle has a feature. You can press a button, and it will read whatever is on the page out loud to you.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So you need to do it sometime if you ever get a chance. It's terrible. It's hysterical, but it's horrific having this. And anyways, but he listened to it like that and loved it anyways.
Wow.
And he told me this and I just was knocked over by that, because if it had been me, I would have been like, there's no freaking way I could love any book being read to me by this really mechanical person. Like, I have a lot of acronyms in that book, like the ITA, it stands for International Transport Authority. And the narrator was saying ITA. The ITA said, and he's like, what the hell is that? You know, I mean, but he loved it anyways, and he bought it, you know, and he wanted to work with me. And that was a great moment. And then, of course, signing with my agent was a great moment. Going on my first tour was a great moment. I went to New York Comic Con and got to be on a panel with lots of cool people.
What? Ugh, miss living the life over here. Jeez.
You know, it sounds like it, right? But I got a whole laundry list of things that have never happened that I'm waiting, you know.
Oh, it will happen, though. It will happen. But that's pretty awesome. And Mindy, if you don't mind sharing, could you share your story about how you got signed with your agent? And from there, perhaps my listeners who are beginner storytellers, beginner writers, can find some inspiration on how they can approach their agents as well in the future.
I had written 4 books. And each book, you learn, you got to do, they say, like 10,000 hours before you become proficient in a skill. And I do believe that.
Yeah.
So I'd written 4 books. The first book I wrote was terrible. I wrote it in college. It was bad. It was 160,000 words. It was just bad. No idea what I was doing. But I sent it off to an editor anyways. I mean, write to an editor, a publisher that would take unsolicited manuscripts. And they said, no, this sucks. No, thanks. So I did what any normal person would do. Next day, I started writing on the next book. This book was a little bit better. It got, but this is actually my sci-fi. It was the first sci-fi, I think. Oh, I forget. They all start to run together. But it was a little bit better, but it's still sucky. But I sent it out to agents and editors, and I got the same response back. This is just not good. And so I started the third book. And again, I was like, well, you know, let's just try something new. And I wrote a third book. It was a little bit better. And I got a couple of, hey, let me read more of this. And I was very excited. But again, it was the rejections ended up being, you're just not there yet. And I'm like, okay, well, that sucks. But I'll just keep going. So I wrote the fourth book. And by the time I got to the fourth book, you know, I had learned a lot. And I was getting good. I was getting good enough that I had a couple of agents request the full manuscript. And then when that happens, you're like, oh my God, this is great. And it's going to, you know, they're going to offer blah, blah, blah. And I had an agent, a really big New York agent, read it and then eventually reject it. And actually they rejected it saying, you know, maybe just fix some things. And I revised it, sent it again, and they rejected it a third time. So for me, this was my 8 mile moment where I was like, I'm going to do this or die. Like, this is the last time, you know, which is stupid. Don't ever tell yourself that. Because you're going to keep failing no matter what. But I went in and I started writing The Nightmare Affair. That was my 5th book. And what I did was, is I decided, okay, all four books were bad. Why? What am I doing wrong? And I, well, what I was doing wrong is I kept writing them the same way. I'm like, well, that's maybe why they keep failing, because I'm not learning. I'm not changing my process. So I went into The Nightmare Fair with a different attitude and a different approach. And what the difference being, in one of my previous books, I completely pantsed the whole time. I had no plans, no character sheets, nothing. I just went in and wrote it and just went whatever seemed right, followed my gut, you know, and sometimes my gut was good and sometimes it was really stupid. And so when I got to The Nightmare Fair, I'm like, I'm going to stop doing that. I'm going to continue to pants, but I'm going to stop and ask for directions. And what that means is, if I get an instinct about what's going to happen next, before I do it, I ask myself why. If I can answer that question successfully, why is the character behaving this way? Why is this supposed to happen? Then I will move forward. And that ended up being the key difference. And by the time I got done with The Nightmare Fair, I had written a book that was coherent, that had the right arc. I had managed to avoid all the mistakes I had made beforehand that I hadn't even realized I had made, you know, until I had changed my process. And I found critique partners online.
Oh, nice.
I had family and close friends that had read it that were really good. But, you know, you really need a critique partner. You need somebody who is doing the same thing you're doing, that's in the same boat as you, so that you guys can learn together and be honest and provide, you know, really critical feedback. So I found her. Her name's Lori M. Lee. She is also a young adult author. Be sure to check her out. Her book is The Gates of Thread and Stone, and then the sequel, The Infinite. But she and I met online, and we really clicked, and she helped me kind of fix the things that were wrong. And then I started querying agents, as I had done in the past with the previous books. But I queried in really small amounts this time. Before, I used to send out like 50 queries all at once, which was dumb. Because if there's something wrong with your query letter, you got to be able to give yourself time to fix it. You don't want to go through all the agents, right? So this time I'm like, well, I'm going to do 5 at a time and then see what they say, what they're coming back with, and see if I need to fix my query letter. My agent, Susie, was in that first 5, and she requested it right away for the most part. Actually, her assistant read it at the time and was like, you got to read this, Susie. So she called me before leaving on a trip to New Zealand. She's like, I need to talk to you before I go because I want to make sure that you know that I want to sign you. So it happened really fast when it finally did happen. But that was after, you know, 5 or 6 years of no's and rejections and refining my process. So my advice to writers, whether they are new or experienced, is the same thing. The first one is don't give up. You got to keep writing. You have to keep writing. You always have to keep writing the next story. And that's true no matter where you are on the timeline in terms of your career. And the other one is that don't be a crazy person. And by crazy, I mean the definition of insanity, where you do the same thing over and over again and expect a different outcome, which is what I had done with 4 books. So I have a right to say that. If it's not working, change. Come at it with a new approach. Try something different. If you will always outline, don't outline. Try pantsing. If you always pants, try doing some more outlining. If you always write third person, try a first person. If you're always writing young adult fantasy, why don't you try, you know, an adult mystery or, you know, just something, you know. Challenge yourself to kind of learn. I mean, you'll learn just by simply trying a new position, a new approach to it.
I really like those tips. Thank you for that. I know you mentioned the query letters, and I'm super curious about that. I've actually personally have never written a query letter. So for people like me in the process of perhaps jumping in and starting to write their query letter and are feeling frozen, what would you advise to people like us who have never written a query letter before? Do you have any suggestions on like, oh, there's books that we should check out, or perhaps reach out to an online writing course?
You don't need to spend any money to learn how to do this, which is the great thing about writing. Query letters are all over the internet. If you go to follow agents' websites, like for instance, I'm with New Leaf Literary.
They're amazing, by the way.
They are amazing. And there are all kinds of links to the query letters that the authors that are with them wrote that you can go and look at. So, you know, look at them. Read query letters that were successful and learn. It's a lot of self-determination and grit and learn. You just got to teach yourself how to do it. And you go out there and read as many as you can. It really helps if you've read the book, because then you can read the query and kind of see. You know, the thing about people when they face a query letter, they're like, oh my God, how do I put, you know, a 400-page book into 2 paragraphs? The answer is you don't. And you don't have to. All you have to do is give them enough to make them want to know what happens next. And writers struggle with that. They try to put in, you know, all this stuff into 2 paragraphs. You got to learn to just knock that out and just grab a little bit of what really is awesome about it. And that's all you need to get them to keep reading. And then, of course, the book's got to be awesome too, a different question. But there's all kinds of online help out there. If you just do a query, in a Google search, you know, for, you know, query letters, you're going to get dozens of hits. Just go from there. Make sure the books are current. That they've been published in the last couple of years. Don't be looking at a query letter that was written in 1998 because, all right, you need to know the market. Make sure that you're seeing what books are coming out now, what books are being sold now. Pay attention to Publishers Marketplace because those books that are being sold right now, they're going to come out in 18 months. And all of a sudden, you're going to have a huge influx of, you know, the new vampires or whatever they are. Mm. You need to know that that's coming because you need to make sure that you're not writing the vampire book after the vampires already happened.
That's true.
And writers don't realize that, especially new ones, if they're not immersed in that world. Now, be careful. Don't get too immersed because you can lose yourself, you know, in so much. There's so much distraction that you don't write.
Yeah.
So you got to find that happy balance. But, you know, get online, get on Twitter. All the publishing is on Twitter. All the agents are there. Follow them. Follow their writers. Listen to the way they chat back and forth. Follow, you know, places like New Leaf. They're also on Tumblr. You can ask them questions. You can't be in your little shell, in your little world. You gotta get out there.
And be proactive.
Nobody is going to do it for you. Nobody's going to knock on your door and say, I have a feeling you wrote a great book. Why don't you give it to me? You know, that's just not happen. Unless you're like a famous actor or something. Yeah. You know? You really, really, really got to go for it. You got to put a lot of effort into it.
Yeah. And you mentioned about finding someone that has a similar background in writing and to critique your work. That's where you met your friend who's also an author. Is that like an online writing workshop in a way?
It's not. So a lot of writers will do, really famous writers, and one that does it a lot is Maggie Stiefvater. She'll do a critique partner dating post on her website. She'll say, okay, if you're looking for a critique partner, come here and meet somebody and date online. That's like a speed dating.
Oh.
And so what you do is you put down in the query, the comment section, what you're working on and what you're looking for in a critique partner. And then people just come by and they look down and they say, oh, this sounds like me. And then you contact each other offline. Well, Lori and I did that. We did it actually. Natalie Whipple had set one up. And that's where I met her and that's where she met me. She had this really silly, this really awesome, very succinct, very short query. And I'm like, this girl just sounds really awesome. I sent her an email and said, hey, do you want to exchange? And so we exchanged the first chapter of our books. And when I read her stuff, I was like, oh my gosh, she's so good. I don't know if I can be her friend. it's so good. I did. I was like, oh my God, like she's better than me. I don't know if I can handle this. But we hit it off and that's how it happened. Now, there were many other people that I did the same thing with that did not work out. Most of it was because they were not as serious. But you'll find people that think they want to be a writer, but really they don't want to be a writer. You know, they're going to peter out after a while. You got to find someone that's really serious about it. And you will have a lot of bad dates. But when you find them, you've got them good. So I know Maggie does it and she's huge. And she does it every couple of months. So if you just kind of hang out a little bit and just wait, or you can even do online a critique partner speed dating. You're going to get some hits even off that, I think.
Okay, that's good to know to like Google that for the listeners who are curious. That's awesome. Could you tell me what's exciting you about your work right now? Anything that you'd love to share with us? What we should look out for?
There's a couple of things going on that I can't talk about.
Aww.
Which I would love to talk about.
Oh, I feel so left out. No, totally kidding. I'm so excited for you.
Because nothing's a done deal, so I really can't say anything.
Aww, fingers crossed though.
So I have a fantasy right now, a young adult fantasy that's out in submission. With editors, I'm really hopeful it gets placed. I call it Pitch Black meets The Pony Express.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
It's like the Greek city-states. So all the states within this country live behind walls because at nighttime, these creatures, they're little mini dragons, basically come out and they will eat anything that's outside the walls that's not protected by magic. And of course, it's a country though, so they're not individual states. They're part of a nation. So they have a royal courier service, and my main character works for the royal courier service. And she has to ride her horse in between the city states within a certain amount of time or she's going to get eaten. So that's kind of where it starts off. She's making a run with a bag full of mail, trying to get in before dark, and her horse gets injured in the opening chapter, and she's worried about getting in before they get eaten.
That sounds so good. I'm really excited to check it out. Well, fingers crossed, but I'm very excited about this.
And then I'm even more excited about what I'm currently working on because your newest book is always your most favorite. It's another fantasy. And then I have two sci-fis that I'm working on. And basically the premise is that what if we had the Independence Day alien ship kind of show up one day but not want to kill us? And so instead of killing us, it transformed our society and it actually ends up being a big gaming unit, and you can download your brain into the game and play the game. And so I'm excited about that one too, which is totally out there, but
awesome. I'm so excited for you, Mindy. That's really cool. And now, what are some of your favorite books that you can recommend to us for us to check out that could either help us in our storytelling career or just life overall?
If you have not read Stephen King's On Writing, that is my first one, of course.
Nice.
It's inspirational. I have to give a word of caution on this one. He says some things that are not true. So be careful about the actual nuts and bolts part. Like, he gives you a word count estimate, and it's a little off. It's a little too long. So make sure that you do your homework. But I listened to that book on audio. Have you ever seen the movie Conspiracy Theory, Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts?
I have not seen it, but I've heard of it.
Well, in that movie, Mel Gibson is crazy, and he has to buy, every time he sees a copy of The Catcher in the Rye, he has to buy it. The On Writing is like my Catcher in the Rye. Every time I see a copy, I buy it. So I have it in every format available.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
I do. But the audiobook is read by Stephen King, so it's very inspirational because you're like, oh my gosh, Stephen King is giving me personal direct advice on writing my own book. So if you've not done that, by all means, do that. He offers very basic stuff about writing, you know, like don't use adverbs, you know, avoid the passive voice. Stuff that's very helpful, but not if you've been writing for a while. For stuff that's more helpful, I recommend The Anatomy of Story by John Truby, T-R-U-B-Y. Have you read it?
I actually have it because I took an online class on UCLA Extension Writing course and my teacher recommended it. It's so funny that you mentioned that because I have it on my bookshelf and I love that book.
And that one is one I read after I sold my first book, and actually it's one of my more recent reads. Some of it doesn't apply because it's for screenwriting, but a lot of it does and it really makes you think about it. So those are probably my two big ones. I also use The Six Stage Plot Structure. Michael Hogge, H-A-U-G-E is his name. And basically, it's again for screenplays, but it breaks down where you should be at like 10% in your story and 25% and 50% kind of in terms of a play. So, you know, stage one is the setup, and then you get into the new situation, and then you have the point of no return. And anyway, so I tend to write cinematic books, so it helps me keep my place in the story. Like when I get that 50% mark, which is the point of no return, which is where the main character goes from reactive type action to active action. So instead of reacting to what's going on around them, they start making decisions and moving forward. It helps me keep my place. So if I hit that point at about 50,000 words, I know I'm writing 100,000K story. So I find that one very, very useful. And you can get it online for free. So by all means, do that.
I'm very, very excited for the listeners to check this out. So before we finally wrap this up, could we find out where we can say hi to you on social media?
I'm on all of them for the most part. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Tumblr, not as much, but I do a lot of Twitter. And you can email me. Everything is on my website at www.mindyarnett.com. And my name is spelled MindyArnett. And you'll find all the links. I have a newsletter. I love to chat with people. So by all means, send me an email, send me a comment on Twitter, and I will be happy to talk to you back.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much, Mindy, for your time and for sharing your stories and all those amazing tips and advice for the listeners. You are amazing, and we'll be sure to say hi to you on social media, okay?
All right. Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Hey, guys. That wraps up our awesome episode with Mindy Arnett. Thanks so much to Mindy for a really insightful and refreshing discussion about her journey as a writer. A huge thank you to you storytellers for listening in. Be sure to say hi to Mindy on Facebook and Twitter, and you can find her at Mindy Arnett. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!